Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Farrelly, and we'll be answering your questions on Conversations with a Bonefish Guide. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcasts. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and also hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now or do it while you're listening to the show. That would be great. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Farrelly about Conversations with a Bonefish Guide. The Colorado River at Lee's Ferry is called by some the world's largest spring creek. It's a massive, clear-running tailwater fishery that runs 15.5 miles from the base of the Glen Canyon Dam to the upper reaches of the Grand Canyon. At times, it gives the impression of being not one or two, but a series of parallel Spring Creek-like waterways. The fishing is great and the scenery is gorgeous. Lee's Ferry Anglers provides professional guide service to this outstanding rainbow trout fishery, as well as food and lodging at Cliff Dwellers Restaurant and Lodge. See for yourself why Lee's Ferry is on every fly fisher's must-do list. Visit leesferryanglers.com or call them at 800-962-9755. That's leesferryanglers.com or call them at 800-962-9755. Before we introduce Steve, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Steve's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Steve's book, Bonefish Barehanded, courtesy of Wild River Press. To learn more about what the publications that Wild River Press has, you can go to wildriverpress.com. View all the books that Tom Perreault there has published over the years. And if you'd like to get a copy of Bonefish Barehanded, you can go there or just click on the link on our homepage. You'll see a copy there, which will direct you over to the Wild River Press website. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be something that Steve and I have talked about during the show. And just submit your name along with your answer, along with your name and location, using that text box on our homepage. It's the same box that you can ask questions at through during the show. So listen closely, take good notes, pay attention, and maybe you'll be the proud owner of Steve's book, Bonefish Barehanded. Our guest tonight is Steve Farrelly. Steve is not a writer, but is a big fan of those who are. During the day, he sells used insurance in a greater metropolitan area. And in the evenings, he struggles to coax responses from maturing D18. He and his lovely wife, the brains of the outfit, enjoy spending weekends out of town in whichever direction friends and family may pull. An avid enthusiast of most creatures that bark, his other interests and hobbies involve anything outdoors and now include, well, bone fishing. Steve, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, great. How is it in New York these days? Has spring sprung?
Yes, spring is everywhere. We spend a lot of time outside of town, too, and it's been fun to watch, you know, the daffodils pop up early, and then we've had azaleas recently and the dogwoods. Everything just looks great. The bees are active, and so we're hoping for some good honey this year.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. You never know what spring brings around the country. So, but glad to hear it's unfolding nicely for you folks out there. Well, let's start out. We mentioned your book already, Bonefish Barehanded, which you recently published. And you chose a different approach than many of the fly fishing books that are published out there. How did you come up with the concept? And tell us what the book is about.
You know, it's funny. It kind of happens by accident. I'll say organically. I tend to be that annoying guy who asks a lot of questions. So if you and I were sitting around having a beer or driving on a road trip someplace, I'd probably ask you 100 questions about podcasting. And just to sort of exemplify that, when I first met my brother-in-law, who is actually a PhD in nuclear physics, a topic I don't know a lot about, I asked him one question and he came back with a very interesting response, which of course begat another question. And then he answered that one. I threw another one at him and he finally looked at me and he said, "Steve, I know way more about this than you really want to hear." And in that spirit, it was kind of the same thing. When I was fishing with Stuart, I always found it, you know, interesting to, you know, just to sort of, I guess maybe it was kind of taking a pause and noticing, you know, and then asking him, "Well, hey, Stuart, you know, the other day we fished over there, now we're going here. Or the other day we were using this and now we're using that. And why is that?" And I just found that it was, he would always, once we got comfortable hanging out and spending time together, his answers got much more longer and much more relaxed. But I always found it really fascinating. And yet I'm not the kind of guy, I wish I were, to keep a game log and really record, you know, the day's activities. You know, Randall Kaufman's book is phenomenal about that, because I think what his premise was, he was basically taking his journal with him everywhere he fished around the world, and that became his amazing book. And, you know, for me, I noticed at one point I wasn't doing that, and so I'd almost ask him the same question, you know, another time. And finally, I turned to him, and I said, "Stuart."
Oop, I think I lost you.
You here? I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. Roger?
Yeah, okay. Got you back.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. No, I turned
you
him
You dropped
at one
off
point.
There.
Oh, is that right?
You dropped off there.
I've got this very fancy microphone.
Yeah, you were saying you started keeping track of the questions, I think, is where you left off from what I
Yeah,
heard.
Exactly. And basically, I turned to Stuart at one point, and I said, "Stuart, you ought to write a book." And he says, "You know, I've always wanted to." And then kind of immediately I thought, you know what, I can. And, you know, why not me? And so what ended up happening was I'd invite him over for dinner and I'd sit down with him. And I happened to type very quickly. And so I would fire questions at him at the dining room table. And my wife's a wonderful cook and he loves to eat. So next thing I know, and he was a great person to speak with. So I'd ask him questions. And again, because I happened to type really quickly, the fun of it was to intentionally try to record what he was saying as he's speaking. And part of that was, I'll say, laziness, because I didn't want to have to get, you know, software that would, you know, be dictation style. And so, but the benefit, the upside was that I'd ask him questions and because I was typing in the moment, I'd have a chance to review it. And then, you know, ask him to clarify. And then I'd spend some time with the content after the fact and then be able to go back to him and say, "Hey, wait a minute, the other day you spoke about X. I have got a question about that, or I didn't really get that." And it was all on paper in the moment, which made it a lot easier to work with the content. So that's kind of how it came about.
Okay. Okay. And before the show, you had mentioned there were some other people that helped you out with the book.
Yeah, I really, thanks. First of all, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you and to speak with your community. You know, I definitely want to recognize and acknowledge that there are a lot of people that are listening that are probably vastly more experienced with bone fishing, maybe, you know, in terms of technique and the amount of time that they fish on the water. And so I'm just really honored to be with your group. I certainly want to thank C.D. Clark, who is the artist for the book, and many of your listeners may be familiar with his fabulous art. He referred me to Tom Pirro of Wild River Press, Bill Rees at Drexel University's College of Design, who runs that. Donna Whitfield DaCosta runs the gallery on Harbor Island. She did all the photographs. And of course, most importantly, my wife, Catherine, who, bless her, has been putting up with me for 10 plus years. None of this would be possible without all those great people, so I'm grateful to them.
And I don't think we've actually identified Stuart fully. And Stuart, is his last name pronounced Clear?
Yeah, Stuart Clear.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead and introduce him so that we know who the conversations are with.
It's funny. Yeah, he's such a well-known figure that I almost forget that. So his father was Bonefish Joe Clear, and I learned so many things, but a bonefish guide will typically use that as a moniker. It's just kind of like going to a bluegrass show and you meet someone who introduces himself as Banjo Mike. I'm like, okay, well, you may never learn his last name, but he plays the banjo and his name is Mike. And but Bonefish Joe is, although he died a few years ago, I never knew him, but he's really in the North Eleuthera area of the Bahamas, really considered the first ever bonefish guide. And the first ever book, at least that I'm aware of, written about bone fishing was written by a guy named Stanley Babson, who fished with Bonefish Joe. And I read that book four times, actually, and it's a really great book, and it's full of stories about Bonefish Joe. And so Stuart really grew up with his dad as a mentor, and the book gets really a lot into that. I mean, I think the book in a lot of ways is an homage to his dad and all the things that Stuart tried to learn from him and then pass on, you know, to his clients. So it's funny, actually, when we were working on the book and it was really starting to come together, I turned to him and I said, Stuart, when this comes out, you're going to be famous. And he kind of rolls in his seat and he says, oh, Steve, I'm already famous.
Sounds like a typical guide. Yeah. I mean, you know, they've got a lot of ego and it's well deserved, you know. I mean,
Stuart, actually, I would actually correct you on that. Stuart is absolutely free of ego. I think his father is well known as being a character and a half, and certainly larger than life. And, you know, Stuart, I even say this in the book, you know, he's very much a church-going man, a family man, a client man. He's one of the most modest people that you'll meet, and he just happens to be really, really good at what he does and makes it really enjoyable for you as the client to be out with him. So he's just a thoroughly wonderful person, and his wife Ivy and his daughter Starvette live right there as well with her kids, and they're just a really wonderful family. And it was fun to go over to his house and sit down with him from time to time and work with the book, and his family's coming in and out, and they're in the photo shoot as well, which is, it's just all fun. They're a really wonderful group of people.
Right. Of all the guides in the Bahamas, how did you end up fishing with Stuart?
Well, so the first time that, of all the Bahamas, well, the first time I ever went bone fishing, my wife, Catherine, her uncle and aunt had moved down to Exuma back in the 70s. They retired down there. And so the first time that we went down to visit them was actually over Memorial Day weekend. And it's funny because I had gone to college in Florida, and when Catherine suggested we go down to the Bahamas for Memorial Day, I had visions of heat and humidity that only Central Florida can provide. And I thought, oh, but that's the last place I want to be, is in the middle of that. Well, it turns out the Bahamas are absolutely gorgeous at that time of year. And when we were down, so we went, and Catherine gifted me a morning with the bone fishing guide. And I had never gone bone fishing before. I think I had tried on my own on a different island, not knowing anything about what I was doing or how, and certainly not having a sense of how to spot fish. But this guide was fabulous. And he took me out, and unfortunately for me, it was high winds. You know, I was not used to swinging an 8-weight rod with something heavy at the end, so I was just an absolute mess. And I say this in the book, I kept handing him, you know, these tangled lines, which he would untangle and handle back to me. But I never got anywhere near actually hooking a fish. And so it was kind of funny, actually, at one point towards the end of the morning, as we're seeing a school of fish coming towards us, he was able to hook a fish probably pretty easily. And then he actually hands me the rod just so I can see what it's like to have a fish on the other end. But he was a wonderful guide. And I was really introduced to, how nice it is to be on the water down in the Bahamas. I mean, what a beautiful place. So fast forward, Catherine and I were on
This was now,
vacation.
now this, excuse me, Steve, that was with Stuart or
No,
some other guy?
that
Okay.
was on Exuma, Great
Okay.
Exuma. And I wish I could remember the name of the guide. In hindsight, I would have included him in the book by name because he was really delightful and very patient with me, and as they often have to be. But no, fast forward, Catherine and I were on vacation in Harbor Island, and I went out fishing with someone, not Stuart, but turns out to be his cousin, Patrick Roberts, who was great. And we had a really great time. And it just happened that the following time that I, maybe when we came back another time on vacation, that I got Stuart, and he's the one that I kept peppering with questions. So I just stuck with him because I'm, that kind of a loyal guy.
Okay, so your first experience was for bone fishing was in the Bahamas, and then you continued on there with Stuart later on a subsequent trip with, fishing with him for bonefish as well. There was a question, have you gone bone fishing elsewhere besides the Bahamas, or is that the one place you've been?
Well, it's funny, actually. I went to a conference. There's the fly fishing tour in that goes around the U.S., and it was in New Jersey. And so I went there, and I was talking with someone, and I brought a copy of my book. And they said, "Well, there's no bone fishing in New Jersey." I said, "Well, yeah, of course you can bone fish in New Jersey. There are no bonefish, but you could go bone fishing." No, so answer your question, no, I have not
Okay.
gone anywhere else. I happen to think the Bahamas are pretty wonderful, and Bahamian
Oh,
people are
they are.
certainly
Yeah.
great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the best places for bonefish. Yeah. And I was just curious. Yeah. Just because, you're living in Florida as well and so forth. But yeah, no, that's fine. So what was your first experience with Stuart like?
That's a great question. It was perplexing because, as a newbie to being on that kind of water. I mean, I, grew up with my dad trout fishing and, with limited success at that. But boy, when you're out on the open water, there's so many different factors at play. I mean, first of all, to be honest, you're distracted because it's just so beautiful. And, it's just a great way to spend a morning, even without a rod in your hand, just to be on the bow of a boat. But, the light becomes such a factor and the clouds and just getting used to trying to spot things that are happening below the water was definitely something that, it's a learned art that I only over the course of spending a fair amount of time with Stuart started to see what it was that he was talking about. But, at first, what you think are just lots of rocks and sticks and holes, at some point, you realize, wait a minute, those sticks have moved. And so there's a lot to it. And it took a while for me to really get used to that. So, and that's even before you really, pick up a rod and try to cast it into a 20-knot headwind. So there's a fair amount going on. It was a big adjustment.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, there's been plenty of days on the salt for me where I think I'm like hallucinating at times. I'm seeing fins and tails all over the place, and it's just little, curls of the waves or something. But, after you've been out there and it's been hot and stuff, and it's hard to see. And then those guys make it sound like, what do you mean you don't see that fish right there? But they do
Oh,
it every, they've been doing it their whole life. They've been looking at fish. And then you and I
yeah.
go down there and we're going, where? I don't see any fish.
Oh, exactly.
So,
I mean, I went out with Catherine
yeah.
a couple of times and she looked at me and said, "I think he's full of it," but sure enough, you get a little closer. Well, the other thing
Yeah.
that's sort of interesting is that Harbor Island and North Eleuthera, you probably don't hear about as much as a bone fishing destination. And that's probably because places I've never been to, like, Andros, are apparently you just have so many opportunities to cast at huge schools of fish. So it's mind-boggling to me to think about that you may have, the chance in a day to cast to 10 schools of fish, which could be hundreds of fish. That sounds pretty good. I'd love to go check it out. In Harbor Island, there are large schools of fish that we have come across, and sometimes one school was leaving a flat, and sure enough, another one was coming onto the flat, and that was pretty amazing. So it gave me a chance to really miscast to a whole lot of fish. But it's, that's part of the adjustment is, sometimes we'd go out and just get skunked, and that's, part of the deal. So you may travel a fair amount and burn a little bit of fuel getting from point A to point B to point C in search of fish. But, there's so many different factors, as you know, involved, such as, you may see evidence of a fish, of a school of fish, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But, Stuart many times would say, I know there are fish here, or there were fish here recently, and then sure enough, 10 minutes later, you see the barracuda, or you see the shark that's obviously spooked the school of fish.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on.
Yeah. What were some of those factors that Stuart considered when deciding where to go, to fish?
Ones that I only really started to wrap myself around. So, certainly the light and the wind, probably principally the wind and the tides, have the most to do with it. And so he's extremely concerned with, as you read about in other books, the tides really do impact the way that the bonefish will, I'll say, approach and enter the mangroves. So when the tide's coming in, the bonefish are going to go further and further back in the mangroves. And, there's a sweet spot. You really want to be there as the fish are coming in and then as the fish are coming out again. So he's very attuned to what the tide's doing in the moment that you're going out with him, which could be in the morning or could be in the afternoon. So obviously it's going to change. The moon plays a factor as well. Obviously, if you've got a very, very full moon, it's going to draw the water further back into the mangroves. But part of the reason he's concerned with paying attention to the tides is even the tides coming out, you don't want to be too far in. You'll literally physically get stuck on a sandbar. So there's that. But as a guide, he is very considerate about your own casting ability. And so, if he sees that you're someone who can, double haul into a 20 knot gale or more, that's probably going to take you to a different place. But he was always kind with me. He'd really bring me to a lee shore where he was trying to limit the impact of the wind on my casting.
I've been there so many times. We did get a question on the internet from Phil in Kentucky. He's asking you, how did your casting, did it get better with coaching? Is he a good casting teacher?
Yeah, he was. I think, to be fair, having some time with the same guide, kind of like my wife and I did a vacation 6 months ago, and I'm not normally the kind of guy to get a docent going to a museum or, traveling a site, and it's so worth it. And that's part of the experience about that made me so grateful about writing the book is that, and I even say that probably in the preface is that, being at least partly Irish, I'm not usually prone to spending money doing something I'm pretty sure I can do myself. And when it comes to bone fishing, that's really making a lot of assumptions and, not just having the equipment, but the know-how, the ability to spot fish, as we were just saying. But yeah, then you get the benefit as well of being able to, as I said earlier, ask dumb questions. And we had one day where we were, I'll say, in between fish. We were poling along and trying to find some. And I thought, here's a great opportunity to ask him about my casting. And so I was kind of looking at the clock thinking, all right, we've only got an hour, and if we've got a good half an hour of distance, we need to travel. So, this may be it for fishing for the morning. And so we had a pretty healthy headwind, and I asked him, well, how do I work on casting into it? I certainly spent some time developing what double haul I have, and that certainly it's a hell of a lot easier to do on open water than it is, in a parking lot. But one of the takeaways I thought was really great for your readers, and hopefully this answers the question, when I was asking him, how do you get a lot of line out into, a 12 o'clock headwind, what he suggested, and I tried it and I can happily say it works, is that he, in order to get line out, would turn to the side and cast at, say, 3 o'clock, assuming you're a right-handed caster, and get enough line out there so that you know. I mean, for me, he was always saying, all right, 40 feet was sort of my sweet spot. Maybe someone's a much better caster, but get however much line out that you're going to need to get to that fish that's at 12 o'clock, and then turn when you've got in your mid back cast, and then throw it out in front of you at 12 o'clock. And that's a lot more effective than trying to get the line out into the headwind. So I can definitely say that works. So I hope your readers can enjoy that.
Yeah, sounds like a good tip. Time to take a quick break here, Steve. If you hold on for just a few seconds, we'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Farley about Conversations with the Bonefish Guide. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage to Ask About Fly Fishing and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer them as many as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Steve.
I was just going to say, what a great name for a fly shop, the Ugly Bug.
Yeah, don't you love those ugly bugs we use? Yeah, they're fun.
Well, it's
Yeah,
funny, just to sort of to answer a question that you haven't asked on that, how do you come up with the name? And people always are challenged to come up with an interesting name. Again, the Babson book was simply called Bone Fishing. But
yeah.
one of the things that, and I won't tell the story because your readers will have to buy the book, but and by the way, probably a third of the book, and this is really the fun of it, are Stewart's stories, anecdotes about being on and off the water, generally relating to fishing, which are sometimes mind-boggling. But there are two stories, one relating to his dad and one relating to him, about catching a bonefish with their bare hands. And so that's where the title
Oh,
of the
wow.
book came about. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was kind of wondering that. Yeah. But you just led into exactly what I was going to ask you next, which was that, yeah, there are a lot of great stories from Stewart in the book that you've related. One of which I thought you could share, or even, paraphrase or whatever, about knowing when bonefish are feeding or not. And he was telling about working with a guest where they were looking at 200 fish. And he was trying to convince the guest, his client, that they weren't feeding. Can you kind of relate that story?
Yeah, so that was an interesting one. So what really, I say, surprised me was he was talking about the color of the fish and being able to see that the bonefish were had their backs are very green, and there's several pictures in the book about close-ups of a bonefish. Unfortunately, one that we were unsuccessful in releasing, so that became part of a photo shoot. But when you're looking at the back of a fish, you really are seeing very pronounced green stripes. And Stewart was saying that he could tell that their color was more green and also tell by their behavior that they simply weren't feeding. And I don't know if that was because normally when you're tracking bonefish, you're looking for the signs in the water. So you're looking for obviously the murky water, you're looking for, those pockmarks of in the sand, holes that have very, very sharp edges, which show you that the water hasn't, relaxed the sides of the edge, and there's a bluish tint to the sand, and maybe we'll get into that in a minute. But I think that he was, in many cases seeing bone fish, but not a lot of that activity. And it may have been also that, because when they're feeding, they're kicking up, they're digging their noses into the sand, so they're kicking up a lot of the sediment of the sand, and that's what makes the water murky. And yeah, I think it was that particular client that was getting a little frustrated and saying, well, one more cast. And Stewart is saying, listen, okay, you're the client, like one more cast, but why don't we try another spot? And so at that point, he was saying that they were successful, and he gave the client one or maybe two more casts, and they did go to another spot and were able to hook up on some fish. Just a quick aside on that, actually, having said that all that the book is many stories like that, I do want to give Stuart credit. Never, ever, ever did he tell me the name of any client. I didn't ask, but all of his stories are anonymous. And yet, for anyone that's ever fished with him or his dad, there's probably a pretty good chance that you're going to recognize yourself or the person you were fishing with, because the stories are pretty funny.
Yeah. And I thought that was interesting because it's so tempting. I mean, you see the fish and you think, oh, they've got a bite, right? They got a bite. And they just aren't on the bite. And the guides know it. And I thought that was very appropriate. And we need to listen, when we're not out there every day and they are, they know what's best, I think, anyway, and from my experience.
Yeah, no, that sort of philosophy was one that came into play in many different aspects of the book, and one of which was working with the publisher, one of which was certainly working with the graphic designer, and then I've got a new website called Bonefish Barehanded. And in many cases in the development of the book, and I know we won't spend too much time on it, but to your point, listening to the experts, and I had ideas about things that I wanted, and yet sometimes they just weren't working. And you really do have to trust someone whose job it is, that you're paying, but you trust them because they know they do this all the time and you're just one client. So I agree with you 100%. And that's, again, that's the value of the guide.
As you worked with Stuart, what did you learn about seeing fish in the water? How did he help you to learn to see fish in the water?
Well, so again, starting with tracking the fish, once he pointed out, he just kept referring to them as the signs that fish were feeding. And so murky water was a big part of it. And yet his ability to see murky water from a great distance, I still find mind-boggling. I know I've said that a lot on the podcast already, but it's true. I really had a hard time seeing water that was, 50 or further feet out that was, somehow more murky than other water. It really is something you got to get used to. I think I got better at it, but the signs that are a little bit more prevalent are when you're pulling along and you can see those pockmarks in the sand from where the fish had been feeding. And there are these tiny little craters that are about the size of, the width of a Coke bottle. And you start seeing those, and when I actually have a couple of pictures in the book of them to really, show what it is that I'm talking about. But when he points out some of the holes, all you see are holes everywhere. And yet when you're pointing out, well, why one whole set of holes is different here than they were, let's say, 10 minutes ago in a different area, you really start to see what the difference is, which is, when the fish have been there recently, they're going down, digging their noses in, looking for probably crabs. And so they get a couple inches down. It's probably 3 or 4 inches down, maybe more. And so if they've been there recently, the sides of those holes are very sharp. And because they've dusted off by blowing water through their mouths to sort of dig down, that's how they dig to create these holes, it takes the top layer of the sand off of the body of the sand, and you can see a different color. It's sort of, Stuart called it bluish, and you can really start to see that, and you think, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. And then if you look at and Babson talked about this going out with Bonefish Joe too, and then you start looking at the holes themselves and start realizing, oh yeah, they're all sharp on one side of the hole. So then you start thinking, well, wait, they're actually, yeah, I get it. They're going in that direction. And if you see a whole lot of them, you start getting a sense of the size of the school. And so, again, Babson really touched on it, but it was only spending time with Stuart that you start seeing, oh, yeah, okay, that I can get that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've not heard someone talk about that before. So basically, I don't know if you'd say sharpness or clarity of the holes, either all together or one side, are telling you whether the fish have been recently there or it was a while ago. And if it was recently, which direction they were going. I think, did I get that right?
Yeah, and the
Yeah.
one thing that I'll add to that is that the reason why the sharpness of the side of the holes exists is because because the water is always moving, right? So the tide's coming in, tide's coming out, and as it does, it softens the edge of those holes. So
Right.
I guess to sort of put a bow on the topic is the sharpness of the holes is there because there hasn't been so much time that's elapsed since the fish have been there to allow the water to naturally, soften the side of the hole. So you could go along a flat that's covered in holes, but you realize, oh, those are all pretty smooth along their sides. So, I mean, I don't know how long
Yeah.
bonefish might have been there, but it wasn't within the last 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah. Very good. Very good. In your book, Stuart was talking about small versus large crabs and them trying to escape into their holes to evade, the bonefish. Can you talk to that a little bit? I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. When I say small crabs, I mean, look at your thumbnail. Some of these crabs are tiny, and the body of the crab may be smaller than that. The body of the crab may be the size of your nail on your pinky. And so, yeah, they will burrow down to get away from their predator. And so that's part of the reason why the bonefish are, that's why they're tailing, right? So, the bonefish, in order to dig, have to effectively leverage their own weight. So their tail's coming out of the water, which is forcing more of their weight down. And so they're now pointing at an angle into the sand and then blowing water out their nose or their mouth to dig into these holes. And again, it's they're looking for crabs. So, but the crabs are all generally pretty small. And there's one of my favorite stories in there that maybe you'll get into is Stuart was actually describing multiple times seeing crabs riding on the tops of leaves, either coming out of the mangroves or, he might even, extend that to say to get away from predators. And there's a story about that in the book, which I just found, I
Yeah,
didn't
go ahead
expect
with that.
it.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, and this is the benefit of, spending time with Stuart in front of the computer and, when we were at the house where we were staying and asking him questions was he would say something technical, I'll say, or an answer to a question of mine. And then I'd have the chance to ask him, well, Stuart, has that ever happened? And then he starts shifting in his seat as he remembers something. And you think, wow, there's a real nugget that's about to come out. And that's why the book is so full of stories, because he's adding so much color to the whole experience. And the stories are the part that I just happen to love. And it was things like the following, which is where he was describing, when I was asking him about what is it that bonefish eat, and it's, for the most part, it's going to be a lot of shrimp and crabs. And when he was talking about crabs, and yeah, he was saying that, they will try to get away from their predators. They're very, very aware of the presence of the bonefish. And so they'll either dig down into their own hole or into another hole. And that sort of gets a little spicy if there's a crab that's already down that hole, because then that crab's going to
Yeah.
force the other one back out again. And, that means the crab may be a bonefish is lunch at that point. But they'll also, excuse me, he was saying that he has seen them coming out of the mangroves literally on the back of the mangrove leaves, which are, probably put two of your fingers together and it's half that size. And they will ride the leaf out of the mangroves, and then he's seen them, as it gets to the side, jump off and scramble up the rocks, which, again, you hear him say that and you think, oh my God, he's full of it. And then you might see that, and it's kind of wild.
Yeah. It's you kind of wonder what kind of brain does a little crab like that have, but
Yeah.
they're built for survival, right? I mean, that's what they do. They need to survive. So, nothing surprises me in nature. I mean, every time you see a new show on TV or something about animals or insects or whatever, it all amazes me, and it's so incredible as to what they figure out to live another day, right? But yeah, I
There's a
kind of
cute
got this when
picture. Go ahead.
I was going to say, when I was reading in the book about the little crabs and the larger crabs going in and out of the holes, and I can just see that as a Disney or a Pixar movie getting kicked out of a hole because there's already a crab in there, right? And then here comes the bonefish. Uh-oh, watch out,
Yeah, exactly. There's a cute picture that I took of one of the crabs just walking along the beach one time, and this little guy is tiny. I mean, again, sort of picture one of your knuckles, and but he was very aware of me being a larger presence, and but there he is, he's absolutely small, and he's looking up at me with his pincers, straight at the camera. And I mean, he was not even an inch across, but he meant business. He was there to defend himself.
One day we were on some pancake flats out in Belize and kind of taking a break. So my son and I were turning over rocks and just looking for crabs to see what they look like, and we're fishing these patterns, right? And what surprised me is that how many different colors the crabs were. I mean, it was like no two alike, and we're so particular about patterns at times, but those little crabs come in all shapes, sizes, and colors. Totally amazed me.
Well, thinking of that, in one of the chapters, I was asking him about, what is it that bonefish eat? And again, crabs and shrimp are most common. And, it's interesting in relation to then, well, how do you pick a pattern to fish with? Very, very frequently did Stewart ever put on a crab pattern? And his comment was, and I say this in the book too, is that, first of all, they're kind of hard to cast. And if the crab pattern lands on the surface of the sand and it's upside down or it's moving erratically, bonefish is just going to look at it. And, Stewart would say, well, bonefish are just going to laugh, but they're certainly not going to strike. And so most of the time that we were fishing, it was with a shrimp pattern. And I'm sure we'll get into it more about what's the technique of actually, trying to attract the fish, but I think a lot of it has more to do with technique than actually what the colorization of the shrimp patterns were that we were using. And I get into that a little bit about the fly selection. And Stewart was really spending, when his description was talking much more about the weight of the fly in relation to how much water you're fishing in. And so you don't want to fish with too heavy a fly in, only a foot or two of water, because you're going to make a lot of noise when it hits the water, first of all, and sink rate has a lot to do with the fly. So, we would generally, if we were in a wading flat or only pulling in a couple feet of water, we were fishing with a lighter fly. But if we were out in, 10 plus feet of water, which we often were, you're definitely fishing with a heavier fly. And that's certainly also going to impact what his instructions are to you, because if he sees a school of fish moving, the only instruction you're going to get is 40 feet, 10 o'clock, or as probably 40 feet, 12 o'clock, or 40 feet, 2 o'clock. And that means in relation to where you're standing, 12 o'clock is obviously straight ahead. What he's seeing is a school of fish traveling from left to right at a certain speed. And he wants you to throw your line out. And depending on the fly that he's got on for you, and a lot of that again has to do with the sink rate, he wants you to position that fly in the best possible way so that you're not spooking the fish before, by landing it on top of them, and you want to have that fly settle, which takes some time, to get down 10 or 12 feet before you're starting to strip it. So, the sink rate is extremely important.
When you were on a flat with a lot of crab holes, he would have you fish a shrimp through that area.
No, that's a great question. No, we would generally be pulling through an area like that. But actually, let me catch myself. I'll say, actually, let me correct that, actually. Short answer, yes. Yeah, I don't remember him ever saying, I'm going to change a fly based on what the conditions of the sand were down below. So that's kind of my way of saying I can't remember, but that's sort of what I recall. We would kind of fish everywhere. The only kind of terrain that we would stay away from is, something that has too much grass in it. So we wouldn't fish that. And so you're generally just looking for flats that have a lot fewer rocks as well. You don't want to get out and do too much wading if there's a lot of rock around, meaning coral.
So that's I was kind of just getting at if Let me put the question another way. Did you have on shrimp patterns more often than crab patterns in general?
Always. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And that actually,
Time.
You know, part of the thing that I also say in the book is that, you know, there was a big realization on my part. I've even got an entire chapter about gear, which is kind of cheeky, honestly, because you see so many people, and I'm guilty of it as well. You know, you go out fishing and you've got so much stuff. And, you know, when you go out with Stuart, I'm sure it's the same with other guides, you know, he's got two rods, he's got a handful of flies, and he's got his sandwich and some water. And that's about it, you know.
Not too complicated, yeah.
No,
yeah.
it's not
yeah.
complicated at all. And, you know, I even say, you know, I make a lot of observation about that in the book. And, you know, I'm not worried that that's going to dissuade someone from going out to their favorite ugly bug fly shop and draining all of the you know, supply there, because there,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of great flies. But Stuart will bring, I'll say maybe more, to be more fair, he probably knows his water and he knows the kinds of flies that he likes to fish. He makes his own flies as well, one of which uses hair from his daughter. His daughter has strands of red hair, and he took one of those and wove it into one of his flies. But he generally only goes out with one, I'll say, bucket
okay.
of flies.
Yeah, let's hold that. I want to come back to that and get into that a bit more here in a minute. We need to take another break. But we did get a message in here from, I don't know how to say your name, Earparf in Denver. He says, I've caught permit with a fly pattern resembling a crab on a leaf. It's amazing to watch. So there
oh
you
my
go.
God. Wow. I've
Somebody
never
else
gone
has
for
had that experience.
I've never gone for permit. That's whoever that fisherman is, he's obviously very good.
Yeah. We'll be right back. Hold on. And just after a brief message here. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves with creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products, including brushes, fibers, and components, have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fish Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve about Conversations with the Bonefish Guide. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A box to send your question. Let's see here if we had. Okay. So, Steve, back at it here again. Let's talk. You kind of led us into the flies, and so I'd like to start out with talking about a little equipment and then talk about some flies and get on to some strategy and tactics here. So what weight rod did Stuart have you fish with?
Always an eight. Yeah, always
eight?
An eight.
Okay.
Yep.
And always floating line, I take it?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, actually, it's a good question. We never went out with sinking line. No.
Yeah, yeah. No reason to. Yeah, always shallow water, so to speak. And what about, did you bring down backup rods? How did you prepare yourself for your trips?
You know,
you
the
know,
first
what did you
time,
learn as you, yeah, as time went on?
The first time I went down, I was loaded for bear and, you know, thought I'd have to, I even brought Christmas Island booties, you know, those wading boots, spent some money on those. I didn't use any of it. You know, all of the shirts, all of the long pants, all of the, you know, the gloves, gaiters. I mean, honestly, I went out and I was, you know, barefoot wearing a bathing suit with no shirt on, with sunblock on, polarized glasses and a hat. And, you know, that was just, and I'm Irish, so it took a while for my skin to get used to it. But after a while, I would just go out, and Stuart's got a rod. He's got the flies that he wants to use. I would, same as him, I'd just show up with a sandwich.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He outfitted you with everything. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, you're only gonna use so many flies, and you know, I mean, my lack of great casting would certainly launch a few into the mangroves that eventually, you know, some of you can't get back. But you're only gonna use in the half a day so many flies, and hopefully you're not gonna lose them all. But he's gonna have more than 10 flies on him, And if you're, you know, in our case, we were fishing the same general pattern. I don't recall that he ever said, oh, this shrimp pattern's not working. Let's try a different one. Maybe I'm incorrectly remembering that, but I don't recall, you know, the same way in a trout fisherman might say, you know what, I'm going to go nymphing instead of using a streamer, or, you know, you know, trying to match the hatch. I don't recall any of
Right.
that.
Okay. So what about backing on a reel? And again, I'm thinking of a story I read in your book about Stuart working with a client who had no backing. Maybe you can relate that story to us.
Oh my God, that was a riot. Yeah, he was, yeah, that's in the book. He was saying that he brings the client out, and some of the clients, oh man, one of them, the guy shows up with just absolutely the wrong equipment. I mean, it's sort of, you know, the kind of thing you'd go out for tuna with, and Stuart's looking at him saying, this is not going to work. I don't know, he didn't say the weight of the rod, but it certainly was something very, very heavy. And but the client wanted to use the equipment, you know, or they've tied their own flies and they want to try their own flies. And, you know, as Stuart said, hey, you know, great, have at it. You know, he's sort of quietly saying to himself, all right, well, I know it's not going to work, but, you know, the guy just tied his own flies, so let him try them. But yeah, the one where he was saying that he's looking at the guy who brings a reel, and he's looking at the reel and he thinks, God, something's a little off. And yeah, he finds out, well, it's because the guy doesn't have any backing on his line. And so sure enough, they get out, and I don't know why he didn't just hand him his own rod with backing on it. I should have asked him. But the guy actually hooks a fish, the fish takes off, the line takes off, and there's no more line on the reel. And at one point, as that's about to happen, the client turns to Stuart and says, quick, put some backing on the reel.
Too late
Which,
now, huh? Yeah.
yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, to your point, many earlier, a lot of times in the course of spending time with Stuart for the course of writing the book, you know, he would say patience is number one. And that's probably a good example of, you know, he might have said, hey, you got the wrong reel. And the guy said, no, I want to use this one. I'm like, oh, okay.
It's you know, and it's so different when you go around the world fishing and salt. You know, some places you go, the guides don't have any gear. Other places they give you all the gear. And so, you know, for those of you out there listening and maybe going to the salt is new for you, that's something you want to talk to your guide or your lodge about before you go down and make sure you're set up. Because I know in Belize, like, forget about going to a fly shop. There's no fly shops to go buy flies. And most of the guides don't have a lot of gear or flies with them. But I know down in, you know, like in Florida, you know, a lot of the guides there have full gear ready to go for you down there. So something to be aware of and, you know, make sure you know where you're at.
Well, you know, and to that point, I was invited to on a trip that'll be in the fall. I'm trying to figure out if I can do it, which is going to go to a smaller island, smaller one of the keys. And in reading through the description and then asking, exactly, it's the same thing. You're in a really, really remote place. Your lodging is going to be modest, is a polite way of putting it. You're really bringing in a lot of stuff. You definitely want to you be clear about what it is that they're providing versus what you're providing, because for these guys, I mean, mail doesn't come very easily. And you know, something that I did for Stuart, and if any of your listeners want to do something really nice for any of the guys that they work with on a regular basis, you know, bring them stuff. Meaning, you know, if they're going to tie their own flies, you know, bring them down hooks that they use, or bring them down other, you know, devices that they may not have access to, because, you know, there's no Orvis down on the other side of the key that they can go to if all of a sudden they're out of something. So, you know, for your guys who like to tie flies, your listeners, you know, that might be something really nice that they could do for the people they fish with a lot, because it really helps them out. You know, it's Amazon doesn't deliver to some tiny little key in the middle of the Bahamas.
Especially overnight, right?
Yeah,
It could
exactly.
take weeks, weeks. Yeah. And I always leave, you know, a couple handfuls of flies with the guides when I leave. And they're always appreciated of that as well. So, but that's always, those kind of gifts are super important, and I'm glad you brought that up. What about leader and tippet? How long were your leaders and your tippet? What did you have to deal with there?
I have to admit, I have no idea. It was
Okay.
long.
That was long. Okay.
Yeah, long enough. I mean, I'll say 12 to 15 feet of leader slash tippet. It was enough that, again, my experience is I'm a mediocre trout fisherman, so I'm used to a 5-weight, 6-weight rod in general. And so anything above that was really challenging for me. So I'm, you're swinging these heavy, heavy flies into the wind with a heavy rod. I mean, there's so much to get used to, and you do, but I don't know. It, when you're swinging a heavy rod, heavy fly, the extra long leader, I think, was just, something more for me to coil up. So I don't think it was any longer than your standard length.
Okay. We can kind of tie this together, I think. But Chris in Avon, Colorado, wrote in and says, "What are your preferred size and top three patterns of flies for clearwater bonefish on oceanside sandy flats?" And my other question relating to that, in case you don't know specifically, were what were the flies in Stewart's box? That probably answers the question.
Yeah, so honestly, you can go pretty well with the Crazy Charlies, and his own Bonefish Stewart special is basically a streamer with a lot of brown feathering and some flashing in it, but generally with eyes, some good weight in there. Those were the patterns that I recognized, more. As I said, I don't really recall ever throwing out any, meaning casting with any crab patterns. And I feel like everything that we fished with was sort of, Crazy Charlie-esque.
Yeah. Okay. Keeping it simple, right? I mean, that and the sandwich. Can't forget the sandwich, right?
And sunblock. Don't
And
forget the sunblock.
sunblock. Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about some of the strategies and tactics you learned from Stuart. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats, like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all types of fish, to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Steve Farley about Conversations with a Bonefish Guide. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, go to our homepage, fill out that form, and send it over, and we'll see if we can't get it answered. We did get one question here on the internet, Steve. Phil in Kentucky is asking, do you ever use stripping baskets to control your fly line while you're on the boat?
That's a great question. No, I never did, which certainly the only time I've ever seen stripping baskets used were when you're wading and you're in several feet of water. And when I was wading in several feet of water and I didn't have one, it became, an issue because you've now got X number of yards of line behind you. But no, on the boat, we didn't happen to. It would, that then puts it on you to make sure that you're not stepping all over your line or having your line wrap around your big toe. But no, I never used one.
Okay. This question came in on the internet from Martin Coleman in Colorado. He says, tell us about a normal day as a guide when fishing for bonefish in your area. How does the day start and end for you? He said as a guide, but why don't we change that to how did a typical day for you and the guide go for bone fishing?
Well, that's actually a great question because Stuart, any of the guys, you know, the preparation for them involves a few critical factors, right? So certainly making sure you got enough gas on board. And there are a couple of stories about Bonefish Joe and fuel and Stuart and fuel, which are certainly entertaining, if not somewhat harrowing, but meaning you don't want to run out of gas. But, you know, they want to make sure that they've got, you know, in Stuart's case, he's got his boat fully, I'll say, loaded, you know, so he's got everything that he needs from a safety perspective, and he certainly has a pre-flight checklist for that. And again, fuel, he always brings two rods with him. He has two different poles of different lengths. One is a PVC pole that's about, I think it's 16 feet, and then he has the shorter wooden pole for shallower water. He's got water on board in a cooler. Doesn't bring your food. That's your job, as well as the sunblock. But then he's there in advance of your start time, you know, a good 10, 15 minutes waiting for you. And, you know, he's going to take you out for the morning, come back for lunch. I never had him for a full day. But if you're going to go for a morning and for an afternoon, you know, he's got his schedule. You know, so he's got his start time and he's got his end time. And he's going to respect it, so you have to as well. And there's at least one story I can think of where one of the clients was, I think, one case getting skunked and was saying, well, you know, can we just stay out here another hour and tell the people behind us that we did so? And you know, Stuart's saying, no, you know, we got to get back. I've got a paying client. Basically, I wouldn't do that to you, so don't ask me to do it to them. So I think he's flexible in terms of where he's going based on the sky conditions, meaning how much light, the wind directions, the tides and all that. But, you know, I think his day pretty much starts, you're going out for 4 hours. So you're going to start, you know, in the morning, come back for lunch. And then when he wraps up in the afternoon, it's going to be a little after 5. And that's, you know, that's pretty much his whole day. But you're in the area where we were, you're only going a few miles and you're always within, obviously, sight of land, but you're never going too, too far out. So I don't think we were ever in any kind of a stressful situation that would cause him to be thinking, oh, today's going to be really different from yesterday. You know, I think the weather conditions probably are what make any day different, but, and of course, the client conditions. That's about it.
Yeah. I'm kind of got the impression that you said you needed to get back for another client. So are a lot of people fishing half days down there?
I don't know.
You
I mean,
fish a full day.
I never fished a full day. I mean, let's be honest.
Oh, really?
It's expensive, you know? So it's, you know, and it sort of goes back to, you know, me thinking, well, why would I pay somebody to do something I'm capable of doing myself? And the answer is, well, because they're really good at it and it's going to save you a lot of time and money. And that's the value of the guide. Plus, you're going to have fun. But no, I mean, a full day
Plus
of
they
fishing.
Have a boat.
Yeah, and there's
Plus
that.
They have a
yeah.
boat.
Well, there was one area that, and depending on the all of the above conditions, there were a couple of times where we just fished a local flat that you could walk to. And that was really fun, too. And actually, sometimes there were a lot of fish. So I think actually the one time we did it, it was because there was something wrong with his boat, now that I think about it. But no, I only went out for half days, and boy, that time goes quickly. You know, you're always wishing, you know, you booked him for a whole day, but you know, it's his livelihood. It's expensive.
Yeah. What, you had a bit in the boat, a bit in the book about what Stuart learned from Lefty Cray. Can you tell us what Stuart learned from Lefty Cray?
Yeah, so that was actually the only time that he ever mentioned a client, and it was because I noticed that he fishes with a Lefty Cray rod. And so I asked him, well, have you ever fished with Lefty Cray? And he said yes. And that actually was one of my favorite stories because, so he's, I'll just paraphrase that. You know, he's going out with, I've never met Lefty, but he was going out with him and they see, I say they, I'm not sure who would have seen the fish first. They see a bonefish or however many, as he said, 100 feet out. And so Lefty starts preparing to cast, and Stewart says, no, let me get closer, let me get closer. And Lefty, look, you can hear him saying it, don't move. And Stewart says, fine. And he said that sure enough, Lefty pulled out a lot of line and then launched it out there. And Stewart's comment was, I thought he had an electric motor on that reel. And sure enough, he set the line exactly where it was supposed to be. And he hooked the exact fish that they were watching. So that's the only story where he mentioned someone. And it was in response to, you know, was Lefty really that good? And Stewart said, he really was that good.
Interesting, yeah. It sounded like from what you've told us so far that you were fishing both from the boat and doing wading. How did your fishing differ between the two?
Well, that's a great question. Wading is a lot of fun, but you know, in a boat, you know, depending on where you are, you know, Stewart's handling the boat to minimize sound. That's where I'm going with this. You know, so he's very mindful of water lapping along the side of the boat, causing noise below the surface of the water, which is going to spook the fish. I mean, you read it so many times in the book, and you just hear about how spooky bonefish are and skittish, and they really are. And, you know, any kind of a sound, I guess with any fish, but for some reason, bonefish are, you know, along the far end of the skiddy chain. He's very conscious of not spooking the fish. So, but when you're pulling along, as long as he doesn't bang the side of the boat or you don't bump the boat in any coral or something doesn't drop along the boat, you're not going to make a lot of noise. But when you're out waiting, there's so many factors. I mean, first of all, you got to shuffle along quietly. You don't want to be lifting your foot out of the water a lot, because then when you put your foot down again, obviously, you know, you risk making a sound with that. But you also don't want to be wading too quickly, because then you're pushing water. And so the ripples that you create along the water are going to be, you know, a couple dozen yards in front of you. And that may or may not, you know, spook the bonefish. But so when you're wading, when we were wading, you're really, you're moving very, very slowly, as quietly as possible. Sometimes we would lift our feet, but I mean, it was honestly like something out of an old Bugs Bunny cartoon. You know, we'd be very, very quiet. And,
you have to do.
Yeah, exactly. But there were some cases where we were in such a shallow area, meaning, you know, less than a foot of water, where we'd even get down on our knees, you know, and not move. But, you know, he'd spot fish and he'd say, all right, get down, because maybe he's predominantly worried about the shadow. And so at that point, mm-hmm. he's, you know, watching where the fish are going, saying, all right, well, let's position ourselves here. And that's something else that's actually really interesting. It's because he's watching always the direction of where the fish are going, and they will be circling, but it may be a wide circle. You know, he's going to be moving the boat, or in this case, you're wading in the direction where you're not trying to follow the fish. You're effectively trying to head them off. And you know, that you can hear why that would make more sense.
Yeah. Did you prefer one or the other, fishing, you know, wading or fishing from the boat?
You know, honestly, just being out there is so amazing. It doesn't even matter. I mean, I even say at one point in the boat, I mean, even if you didn't have a rod, you're going to have a great time.
I hear you.
Yeah. But no, I do like, actually, the wading was really fun. And the biggest fish that I caught actually was wading. And you know, going back to your question earlier about backing, you know, your more knowledgeable anglers listening will certainly be familiar with when one of these things, when you hook a bonefish and they take off, and you know, all of a sudden your line is absolutely off the reel and you're into your backing, and you know, you're fighting the fish, which basically means letting the fish slow itself down for, you know, could be many, many minutes. And you know, you're trying to gently bring line back onto your reel rather than, you know, having it stripped behind you, which sometimes you have to do if the fish is coming at you, but in order to keep tension on the line. But, you know, it's so exhilarating when, you know, you go into your backing and it takes forever to try to bring the fish in. Obviously, you're trying not to snap the line. But that fish that I ended up landing, which was He figured it was 7 pounds, and a friend looked at the photograph and said, "That's a pretty conservative seven," meaning it was probably more than that. That fish took me into the backing twice, and then it was still well into the line when I finally got him in. It was a really, really fun day.
Did you primarily fish to schools of fish or to more solitary or doubles or triples?
You know what? You're in no control over it. You know, it's I don't, Stuart, that I never saw any evidence that he had a sense of where there may be a bigger school versus a smaller school. Obviously, he's always going to try to take you to wherever there, you know, would be the best chance of seeing fish. But it's a great question. I'd say probably, let's put it this way: if you saw a large school of fish, you got pretty excited. So, you know,
Yeah.
with that, I think most of the time you might see, you know, three or four. There were many times where we saw three or four absolute lunkers, or even two that, you know, from if I could see them in pairs, you know, 60 feet out, they felt like they were the size of your arm. Needless
Yeah.
to say, I
Did
didn't
you?
we didn't have any success.
Yeah, that was kind of where I was going is, did you purposely going out? Go out looking for larger fish. Is that possible, or is it kind of just the luck of the draw being in the right place at the right time?
I'm going to say luck of the draw,
Okay.
my observation. And
Yeah.
that's where that's sort of what it goes back to, is why I think people probably go to places where they're very known for large numbers of large schools.
Yeah. Did, tell us how Stuart coached you to present your fly. What was his techniques?
You know, I think his technique was basically to put you in a position where it put me in a position where my own lack of experience was going to have the least amount of impact in spooking a fish. And so that means what he's doing is he's watching how far you can cast and how well you can cast and how well you can cast into the wind and in different conditions. And so what he's always trying to do, very quietly, I might add, as he's handling the boat, you're not really aware of how much he's really helping you out. But he's always trying to give you know, a cast in favorable direction of the wind at a distance that's one that you're evidently, you know, comfortable casting to. And as I was saying before about him watching the direction that the fish are swimming, he's going to want you to put your fly out pretty far in advance of those fish. Again, to let the fly settle, but also so that if you know, miscast it, which frequently did, he would actually often say, "You know what? Pick it up again, throw it out again." So because I hadn't either gotten it far out enough or was casting, you know, a little bit off course, you know, he really wants the fly to settle into the sand before the fish get there and have you be in the right position with it. And if it takes a couple casts to do it, then, you know, that's that. But I guess to better answer your question, he wasn't like a Tom Rosenbauer who's going to sit there and tell you know, do this or don't do that. He is going to say, well, you know, how do you grip the rod well versus improperly? You know, he'll give you
Yeah.
tips on stripping techniques, certainly.
Yeah, that's what I was going really getting at is, you know, how did he coach you to strip the fly? You just said, you know, he wanted you to lead it, let it settle, let the fish come to the fly, and then what stripping techniques were you taught?
You know, stripping techniques were basically listen to what Stuart says and do it, meaning he's watching the fish, and I had no ability to see what he was spotting, which is how they were behaving in relation to my fly. And granted, he's a couple feet up higher in a polling platform, but still he's experienced. And so what he's actually watching is how the fish are spotting, seeing, and responding to your fly. So what you're doing is you're stripping the line, keeping the rod tip low, meaning just above the water, like an inch, stripping the line maybe a foot. And what you're basically trying to do is to emulate a shrimp that's swimming away from, maybe swimming freely, but maybe swimming away from the predator. And so you're trying to strip it a foot so that the shrimp pops up off the sand, swims away a little bit to catch the bonefish's eye, and then it settles into the sand again. And what Stuart's trying to watch for or the fish turning on that to start following the fly. And so what you'll get from him are instructions that'll say, all right, strip, stop, strip, stop, strip. And then he may say, all right, give me a long strip, which might be 2 feet, stop, and then maybe a long strip to set the hook. But that's really, that's the only instruction you're going to get from him.
Okay. No, that makes good sense. And you just told me, I think, how you set the hook. Use a strip strike to set the hook, and then you're off and running, right?
Yeah, you're definitely not raising the line. You know, and I even say that in the book, you know, as a trout fisherman, that's certainly what my dad always taught me. As soon as you get the sense, you know, raise your rod and that'll set the hook. And that doesn't do it with the bonefish. The bonefish have a very, maybe for various reasons, but among them, the bonefish have a very thick jaw. And so, you know, and that's actually one of the things he says as well about keeping your hooks have to be extremely sharp. And I know trout fishermen are good with that too. But, you know, in order to get your hook set into the jaw of the fish, which is not going to hurt the fish, you're stripping straight behind you, you know, a good 2 feet at a pretty good clip, and that will set the hook. And then once you've got the fish on, that's when you start to raise your rod. And what you're doing by raising the rod, by the way, is simply trying to get the line off of the water and away from any other obstructions, as well as keeping pressure on the line, obviously, to try to keep the fish on. But, you know, the line, because you've got so many, you know, obstructions such as coral everywhere and little mangrove shoots everywhere, which Stuart affectionately refers to as the bonefish getaway. And, you know, if your line is high up in the air, you're going to really limit the amount of line that's on the water or below the water that might get entangled. So that's when you're actually raising your rod.
Yeah. Sounds like fun. I wish I could go tomorrow.
Me too.
It's so much fun to talk about bone fishing, and just being on the salt, like you said earlier, is just wonderful in and of itself. But Steve, we're out of time. We didn't get to everything I wanted to talk about, but you know, we could sit here and talk all day. That's always the case here at Ask About Fly Fishing. But
well, there's one thing that
on tonight.
Absolutely. There's one thing that I did want to add, and that is that all of the proceeds of the book, all profits, are going to go to charity. I think Paul Newman had the right idea, first and foremost. So any profits on the book are going to go to either education or island cleanup in the Bahamas, or to preservation and conservation of bonefish habitat, which, you know, points directly to the Bonefish Tarpon Trust. But, you know, again, all the proceeds from the book are going to go to charity. So if that entices anyone to pick up the book, I encourage them.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And we're going to give away your book in just a minute, along with a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And again, Steve's book is called Bonefish Barehanded. We're giving away a copy tonight, courtesy of Wild River Press. And Tom Perot at Wild River Press has supported our show for many years and provided a lot of guests for us, just like Steve. We'll be giving away those things in just a minute. One more message here, and we'll do just that. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites like threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. So there's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. And just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show, so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of the great prizes we have to offer. Now, if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So the first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. And our winner for that is Roy Fukushima, Roy Fukushima in California. So congratulations, Roy. And I know you'll enjoy your membership with FFI. And the second thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And to learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org. Again, another fine organization to support. So check them out. And our winner for that is Vito Paslaquea. I know I destroyed your last name, Vito, in New Jersey. So, Vito, congratulations on your membership to Trout Unlimited. I hope you enjoy that, and I know you will. And so now we're going to give away a copy of Steve's book, Bonefish Barehanded, courtesy of Wild River Press. And if you don't win his book tonight, go buy one. Just like Steve said, help support the great causes that Steve's donating the profits to. So here we go. What's a unique... Oh, so the way we do this is you've got to put your name, your ad, you know, your email address and your location along with your answer in that text box on the homepage of our website. And the first person to answer the question wins and win a copy of Bonefish Barehanded by Wild River Press and Steve Fairley. Okay, question is, crabs, you know, get from one place to another in many different ways. What's one of the unique ways Steve mentioned on the show tonight as to how crabs travel to avoid bonefish? Okay, so that's our question. Just waiting for an answer. I think that'll be a pretty easy one for them, Steve. So we just got it in the queue and waiting for a person to give us an answer. There's a slight delay before they actually hear what we're doing. So, all right. Yeah, we've got, looks like our first answer is from Victor Hahn in Golden, Colorado. Victor says leaf. Is that correct, Steve?
That's correct. And by the way, if the winner wants to mail the book to you and then to me, I'd be happy to sign it and send it back to him.
Okay, I'll let you. Okay, I've got the book, so I'll be sending it to Victor.
Okay.
So you're saying if I send it to you, you'll send it to Victor?
I'd be happy to. Sure.
Okay. All right, so Victor, send us your shipping address so that we can get that taken care of. And Victor has won many times on our show and has been a long-time listener. So congrats, Victor. And I know you'll have a fun time reading the stories about Stuart Clear and Steve's experiences with Stuart. So enjoy. In that same text box that you answered the question, Victor, just put in your shipping address and we'll be good to go on that. Steve, thanks so much for being on the show with us tonight. It was a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for taking your time on the late night in New York to be with us. Truly appreciate it, and hope you enjoyed it as well.
I did very much. Thank you to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. Hopefully you all have found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line menu. In the archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 390, and if you'd search by keyword phrase like tarpon, trout, permit, bonefish, Madison River, Bighorn River, whatever you search for, you'll probably find a show on it. So go out there, poke around, and have some fun. Our next broadcast will be on June 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show I'm going to interview Jim Stenson. Our topic of the show will be A Tale of Three Fish. Jim has traveled the world to fish for many species. The Holy Trinity, as some call them, are still three of the toughest fish to catch: permit, steelhead, and Atlantic salmon. And they can frustrate even the best fly fishers. So join us to hear Jim talk about some of his exciting and difficult adventures in search of these elusive fish. To make sure you don't miss this, just add this to this upcoming show to your calendar. Click on the Add to Calendar button below Jim's photo on our homepage, and you'll be all set. It'll add it right to your calendar. You'll be all good with that. I'd like to thank Wild River Press, Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, These Fairy Anglers of the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Enrico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.